All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. And it keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJS at 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
Hello and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon. Today we're going to be discussing loosely, but also focusing on some details of learning philosophy, learning to do philosophy, learning how to learn philosophy, kind of our experiences, maybe, you know, in and out of school. I know that I did a bit of studying philosophy even before I went into college and university, and I know that you have finished university and you've continued your own studies, and part of doing the show involves that. So we'll be discussing kind of what our experiences were and how that maybe shaped how we think, or how our thinking shaped how we learned even. But before we get into that, let's get into our quote and quandary segment, where just by way of introduction to the show, we will be bringing up a quote that we've found particularly interesting, and a quandary, a question, something that we've been thinking over.
He is the author of The Little Prince, which many of you probably know, quite a famous children's book. He's French. He has a very French name. It's Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. You know, I really should have looked up how to pronounce his name before the episode. I've read The Little Prince, and which is one of my favorite books, and I'm currently reading his quite well-known nonfiction work, kind of an autobiographical work about called The Wind, Sand, and Stars, which is basically an adventure book about him. He was a pilot throughout the kind of 1920s, 1930s, and then ultimately ended up dying in World War II, flying. During the 1920s and 30s, he was kind of like an adventurer pilot. He worked for the French mail service, so during the French Empire, so he flew a lot through Africa. And this is basically a recounting, an autobiography, or a memoir about his period, about some life period in that, and being a pilot in that era, and, you know, getting kind of, you know, I think, I know a little bit of the story, I don't want to ruin it, but, you know, I think at some point he crashes in the desert, and his story getting out of there, and all that kind of stuff. But he definitely, you know, anyone's ever read The Little Prince, there's a lot of sort of philosophical, meditative, and ethical undertones, you know, about human relationships and, you know, one's place in society and, you know, kind of forming what's important. And a lot of that comes through in this work as well. And one of the cool things that I think he talks about quite a bit is his relationship to, you know, the meaning of being something like the pilot, his relationship to the machine, his relationship to the work, to the craft, to the practice, of all this kind of stuff. And he has this really interesting quote that I like, and I'll talk about for a second. I was originally just going to read the underlined section for all of you, but I'm actually going to read, it's a short little paragraph because it kind of gives a little more context. So he's talking here about how peasants relate to, you know, how peasants' work relates to the world. And then he's kind of the real quote I'm focused on is, you know, how actually, you know, being a pilot also relates one to the natural world as well, kind of surprisingly. So he says, even as the peasant strolling about his domain is able to foresee in a thousand signs the coming of the spring, the threat of frost, a promise of rain, so all that happens in the sky signals to the pilot the oncoming snow, the expectancy of fog, or the peace of blessed night. And this is the main part of the quote that I really liked. The machine, which at first blush seems a means of isolating man from the great problems of nature, actually plunges him more deeply into them. So I really like that quote. I'm going to read the last part one more time. The machine, which at first blush seems a means of isolating man from the great problems of nature, actually plunges him more deeply into them. And the machine, obviously, there is his plane. You know, he's, this is, you can imagine a kind of biplane or whatever, right? This is reflecting on a time, I think, in the late 20s or early 30s. But I thought it was interesting because I think we have this tendency to see technology as kind of transposed against nature, right? You know, it's this kind of like, you know, you get this technical world, it's a world of machines, the Industrial Revolution, the Digital Revolution, farther and farther from the natural world. But a lot of what Anton is talking about in this work is how being a pilot requires, like, being able to, you know, be, you know, engaged with the machine and be a part of the craft of flying, all this kind of stuff, you know, allows or causes him to engage in the natural world in ways that he would not otherwise have been able to. And we kind of, it made me think a little bit in the show, our listeners will know, in the past we've talked a lot about Heidegger and this kind of existential phenomenology, and I kind of saw this, it's a reveal, what happens when you engage with a specific kind of craft, and by craft I don't actually mean like the vehicle itself, I mean like the way of working with a vehicle, or the way, in this case, the way of working, like piloting is a craft. That basically one ends up engaging with the natural world, or things about the natural world are revealed in ways which otherwise would have been concealed had one not been participating in that craft, even though that craft is highly technological and highly technical. So I thought it was a really interesting quote revealing that.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, I don't think it was necessarily... Obviously, McLuhan talks about extensions of man. It's not that he, I don't think he said that technology is an extension of man. I think in Understanding Media, he specifically singled out games as the extension of man. But it makes me think of, well, we have these natural faculties for exploring the world, organs for sensing it, you know, legs for ambulating through it, for walking through it. We do kind of, by way of cliche, have this idea of technology as being isolating or fragmentary or something like that. That's actually something that I'll maybe get into with my quote a little bit too, just through the elaboration. But this idea of like fragmentation and technology is fragmenting us. Well, there is this question of like, well, why is that? Or even primary to that, like, is it really doing that? And I think that this quote is trying to show a bit of resistance to that yes, airplanes actually, yes, they connect us. Maybe Heidegger is right that the earth shrinks in that sense, but they still do connect us in a certain way. They've opened up horizons of possibility and whatnot, even apart from I was thinking specifically of the mechanics. Right, like actually working with the machinery and whatnot. Like, there's a whole world of maintaining planes and whatnot.
Within the context of the work, he talks a lot about, you know, as a pilot, you begin to, you know, read and see things about the ocean, the sky, the mountains, the wind, all this kind of stuff. All things that otherwise, for example, the peasant that he said transposing himself against, just like the peasant has ways of relating to all those kinds of things, there are new ways in which a pilot relates to those things that a peasant, through his peasant work, could never see. Like, they're just, it's just not, it's just not what within the field of knowing within that kind of life, but becomes revealed when doing it on a whole other kind of practice. And that practice requires engaging with technology in a certain kind of way. Why don't you say your quote, and then we'll go to the quandaries.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So my quote comes from another book that I pulled from the free book piles at the university. There's just always interesting stuff that's getting tossed out of offices and whatnot. Even if it's a little dated, it's still interesting to find and work through. So this comes from the book pile in front of the education department, actually. It's from a book called Community, The Structure of Belonging, by a guy named Peter Block. Now, this is actually the epigram to, or is it epigraph? I think it's epigraph. I think it's the epigraph to this book. And I was interested in picking up this book because, you know, community and world and relations and whatnot, If someone's going to give like a systematic account of how communities work, that would be really interesting. As I started reading it, I realized that the author is a bit more of a consultant, sort of business side and whatnot. So it reads a little less philosophical, even though it's touching on, you know, ethics and morality and whatnot. But I say that to introduce that Peter Block does also kind of succumb to the fragmentation cliche of, you know, nowadays we are so fragmented. He even says, it's interesting, right? There's this kind of shows its date. He laments the invention of things like play dates, you know, when parents arrange for their kids to go over to people's houses.
Yeah, because it's bringing this sort of like a structure or bureaucracy to childhood in a way or whatever.
Right? Exactly. But I can think that, you know, that's pretty, it's pretty benign, and it's even maybe a little bit of structure is good. Play dates like did go away, and I can imagine that they would in our, you know, technologically mediated world where you don't have to go over to someone's house to play with them. You can just play like Roblox or something with them.
Roblox. You know what? Your AI friend is always there for you. You don't need that.
Peter Block has kind of like played into this fragmentary idea that like already has put me on a skeptical tone to read this book. I'm still going to read it in any case, but I'm going to read the... I saw you typing away. Did you look up whether it was...
Oh, you know what? I was looking up for our listeners. Peter Block, you were right. He's a consultant. I was looking up because he has the last name of a philosopher that I remember hearing about. So I was thinking it was one of the same guy, but it's not. He's an American author, consultant, speaker in areas of organizational development, community building, and civic engagement.
Well, in any case, the first sentence that you're met with when you actually open the book is, he quotes Sigmund Freud, interestingly, who says, the first human who hurled an insult instead of a stone was the founder of civilization. Now, I find this interesting because I'm trying to think of how or why someone who is advocating community and connection would include this, right? It is an anti-violence quote. It's a quote in service of some kind of civility. Yes, even though they're using insults, there's something about an insult that seems to substitute well for a stone, right? There is something kind of satisfying, almost like pre-critically, pre-ethically about revenge. There's just something sweet about it. But the psychological structure or the society you have to be in to be satisfied by mere words directed at someone, I think is interesting. I think it's interesting too, though, because I don't know if Peter Block is trying to pull on this ambiguity, but I think it goes to the heart of what a genuine community makes possible, and that is the possibility of hurling insults, right? Communities, real communities, are pretty messy, right? They enable drama, they enable reputations to rise and fall, right? We really do seem to have some kind of need for an outlet for our slights and our bruises. I don't think Peter Block is trying to paint an ambiguous and poetically tense picture of community. I really do think that he's trying to do the like polished thing, you know?
Because when I hear that quote, my immediate thought, I was going to say, that's a good quote. Do you want to say it one more time for the...
So Peter Block quoting Sigmund Freud, "The first human who hurled an insult instead of a stone was the founder of civilization."
Yeah, and I think, you know, I was doing some reading recently. Actually, that'll come up a little bit in my quandary. But basically, you know, I think most people thinking about like the formation of human society would agree, or stable societies or whatever you want to call it, is that, you know, there has to be some level of expectation that basically we're not just going to kill each other. And so the as much as it seems kind of like backwards, the insult in a way when, from that quote, what I read here is it's the first step up from, you know, the sort of base, you know, use of violence, of physical force to, you know, attain one's, you know, needs or protect oneself or express anger or whatever. And instead, you know, the society, as you kind of said, like, it is basically you're taking the next step up and saying, we're going to settle things through communication verbally. And so that might mean telling people to go, you know, F themselves or hurling insults at them or whatever it's going to be. But at least that's not, you know, beating them up or killing them if you disagree with them or if you have something that you want, right? Now we get into this, the area where we discuss barter, reason, insult, whatever, right? That makes up, if anyone pays attention to modern politics or even just any sort of social relationships, all are components of how we perceive those things in the realm of public discourse and in our private lives too, actually. With that, should I jump into my quandary? Because it's a little bit similar, actually. So for our listeners, I've actually been reading as much as you find books at the university, sometimes I find books randomly at my work, and this one was basically in the garbage. It's The Elements of Moral Philosophy by James Rachels. I'm sure you are familiar with it, and I'm sure if any of our listeners have taken a first-year ethics course or anything like that, then they have probably actually read excerpts from this. This is a classic, first year. I think we've used pieces like chapters from this for shows. Yeah. It gives a very brief structure of different kind of moral theories, and it's very accessible. And if any listeners have any interest are dipping their toes in the moral philosophy or ethics, like, it's actually a great starting point, and it's been around for a long time. But, you know, the first section is on cultural relativism, and I don't want to talk too much about cultural relativism specifically. It's an interesting concept, it's kind of related, but more what I wanted to talk to was bias, and how I think this is a more just general quandary. It made me think a lot about how, as much as we as philosophers, this is a philosophy show, we want to be rational and reasoned and objective, there is always going to be this pull to what is most comfortable and most familiar. And it's really, really hard to kind of proverbially strip the paint back past all the things that you're familiar with to get to some sort of, you know, personal standing. And there's actually a quote near the end of the chapter I was going to read out because I quite liked it, from Herodotus, who is the ancient Greek historian. So this is not actually a James Rachel quote. This is Herodotus. And Herodotus said, you know, this is probably 25 years, 100 years ago, whatever. For if anyone, no matter who, were given the opportunity of choosing from amongst all the nations of the world the set of beliefs which he thought best, he would inevitably, after careful consideration of their relative merits, choose that of his own country. Everyone, without exception, believes his own native customs and the religion he was brought up in to be the best. Now, especially with a more globally connected world, technology, maybe there's people who are going to be a little bit more open to other cultures and all this kind of stuff, and maybe thinking, hey, the way the people around me do things, it's maybe not the best. But I think the point still stands that it's extremely difficult for most of us to take a really big step out of our own belief system, out of our own value system, and adopt another one or recognize another one, especially when it comes to things, you know, with cultural relativism, there's a lot of discussion around values, right? And how actually values can remain pretty consistent amongst different cultures and all this kind of stuff. And it's kind of actually a little bit of like a defeating point for cultural relativism. But different cultures do have different sorts of sets of values or concerns. And we are always kind of already in a kind of echo chamber of values and concerns and what you might call phenomenology, like care, what to care about, that just seems very, you know, taken for granted, but very hard to step outside of. And so for myself, it's something I try and do, but especially for our listeners, like trying, I guess on some level, like the antidote or the step that one takes, although it's like never full, and that's kind of the big point, is like we think about people like Descartes and stuff like that, where you enter a system of, you know, radical doubt, where it just becomes like, you know, is everything that I, even the most familiar stuff, the most background stuff, is that really the case? Now, the irony with someone like Descartes doing that is Descartes ultimately finds a way to reaffirm his whole system, which is kind of the point that I'm making, is like, even when we do that, we have a tendency to circle back around and orient and fit things back together. So in fact, like my way of life and my perspective actually, maybe with some slight tweaks and tinges from, you know, this whole process, but the whole interpreting process has a tendency to circle back around and more or less leave the picture the same. We can end up being kind of caught in a little bit of a philosophical trap of familiarity.
Yeah, that's something that I've thought about and tried to kind of not address like in my own life, but always tried to be mindful of, was that when we approach things like skepticism or like, you know, cultural relativism from like a comparative lens of like, okay, well, putting, you know, customs side by side, everyone would prefer like their own. How do we, but like, we need some like higher standard, or how do we find something that like really gets like a rational standard or something like that? All of these kinds of skeptical or relativistic evaluative systems themselves suppose a certain value to like to their own skepticism, right? To finding the truth behind, you know, there must be some like uniform kind of reason, or if there's differences, there has to be like an order behind them. So you already have values like inquiry, a value for truth, a value for ordering things when there is genuine differences. So you can't ever really, like any skeptical project that tries to exit your own perspective already brings with it certain values into that project, right? So, and the thing is too, like you tend to find that, you're talking about like the self-perpetuation of these things. It's not surprising that the diehard skeptics are the ones who don't come to any conclusions, right? Like some of them just like put their hands up and are like, well, you know, they take like a hard relativist position. It's like, well, you can't really compare them. Or like you have the skeptics who say there is a truth to, you know, moral evaluations, but we'll just never arrive at it. So I'm going to keep my hands off any of them here.
Yeah, and I think the irony with the hands-off approach, or the more kind of like cerebral approach you're talking about, whether it be kind of a radical skepticism or some sort of commitment to relativism, is like what ends up happening is the individuals who take those sorts of positions end up taking them as intellectual positions, and then live the same way they always have regardless. So with no shift. So ultimately, it's sort of like a false non-commitment where you're like, oh, I recognize my own system or what I'm familiar with and my own values, my world, you know, that kind of all this kind of stuff is probably doubtable, or is just as, you know, there's a whole bunch of other systems that are just as viable, and there's no way to measure them out or really compare them. So therefore, I'm just going to continue doing the one that I'm like the most familiar with.
There's material reasons for that, right? Like it's really hard to extract yourself from your social setting, from your country where those customs are practiced and like normative. So it's really easy to do that intellectually, but like the reason that people, you know, like some people might do this, like they might become a hermit or something, or they might like, you know, go to India to find yourself or something like that, you know, do some like exit your world and go into another one. Now, I think that there's a healthy way to do this where you do put yourself in some kind of dialogue with, or like trying out, because I don't know how much you can like really do that without immersing yourself in another world, but some kind of like practical dialogue with something like that can be a way of doing that. But again, the material conditions are just like so kind of, not, I don't want to say like restrictive. Again, you can do it, but there's reasons that people, it's very easy to intellectually entertain things. But then when it comes to brass tacks, it's like, yeah. So I don't know how I necessarily got onto this, because I don't, like, I guess I was thinking about, so one of the things that I do like to think about is philosophical problems per se, and to try and think of, like, what are their conditions, right? Because people, like, look, I don't know how to break it to all, you know, the real philosophers in the audience, but, like, most people are not thinking about, like, you know, how does the mind interact with the body and stuff like that. They kind of are just like, they have problems that have solutions. Philosophical problems are kind of defined by the fact that, like, if there was an easy answer, we would have just like arrived at it, right? Like, the mind-body problem is conceptually, philosophically problematic. So maybe I was thinking about this in regards to that, but I was thinking about it came up somewhere and then my roommate brought it up and I was like, listen, I'm gonna shut this down. I was thinking about simulation theory, you know, this idea that really we're just like in a simulation, and that you don't know it, because there's like, you know, that, like, if it's all constructed, why would they put hints in? But I guess like somehow people do perceive hints, you know, there's like glitches in the matrix, there's patterns people see, and it's like evidence that we're in a simulation.
I was gonna say, with this whole the simulation theory, not to get too off track, one, I don't believe in that at all. It's become like a popular pseudo pop philosophy thing. My biggest issue with the simulation theory is that it basically, that from my understanding, that our really kind of simply construed version of it is simulation, a world like simulation is totally probable or possible or inevitable to create. Therefore, in the future, it has been created. Therefore, it's been created, you know, an infinite number of times. And therefore, our society is far more, you know, it's far more likely that we're in a simulation than not in a simulation. The obvious, the immediate problem to me with that is that it presumes that, like, our kind of world could be created in a simulation, which is something I believe we're still a very, very long way from. So it's sort of like presupposing that that is a thing that's already happened sometime in the future.
Well, yeah. So the problem with that, I think, is that it conflates possibility with necessity, right? It's possible, therefore someone has to have done it, right? I think that particular approach to it might, because this, here's the thing, right? You need necessity for this, because if it's just probability, then it's not really convincing. What really convinces people that they are in fact in a simulation is the necessity of it. Having grasped some kind of supernatural, and I mean that into like beyond our capacity for like evidence or anything like that, some supernatural way that you've arrived at some truth. I'm not just saying, well, we could very likely be in it. A person who actually believes this has some kind of proof for it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when it comes to other like kind of great cosmological or reality-based arguments, I immediately think about, you know, arguments for God or whatever it's going to be, like the ontological argument and stuff like that. These sorts of arguments for God generally almost never work on probability. It's never an argument about like, oh, so therefore it seems pretty likely that there's a God. It might not be the case. See, they're all, now, I'm not saying those arguments are good, but the point is that, to, like, just as you're saying, to be convincing, to be something that people can, you know, pick up and hold as a tenant of like their belief system and understanding the world, then it needs to at least have the appearance of being a certainty, of being, as you said, like a necessity, and not just, oh, well, probably in the future, it would seem likely that they'll create this thing, and therefore they could create it multiple times, and within itself, it could create various versions of itself. So the probability is super high. You know, it's still totally probable that it's untrue.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, so it's this necessity point that I wanted to kind of bring up as my quandary, because like this is a fact, like people do believe in this stuff. I think Elon Musk has gone